This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Transmission of the Light, Case 1. Shakyamuni Buddha realized enlightenment on seeing the morning star. He said, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Kazan's verse. One branch stands out on the old plum tree. Thorns come forth at the same time. So this, beginning on Friday night, we began our annual enlightenment vigil, celebrating the enlightenment of the Buddha. And so we began with Fusatsu and then essentially just had an open zendo and an open space in which to practice during the 24 hours of the day. And we just concluded this morning. And as I said at the beginning on Friday night, that the way we celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment is by not just turning towards him with devotion and respect, or valuing the teachings, but by doing that very thing that the Buddha did, and that all practitioners have done since the time of the Buddha, that's how we celebrate. That's how we honor the Buddha's enlightenment. And it's significant in the dedication to the service we did this morning that we were expressing, we're dedicating the service to the enlightenment of the Buddha. It's always, I remember early on, it getting my attention that the Buddha seemed to be this rather significant person within the Buddhist tradition. And yet there wasn't a lot of attention given to the Buddha. I mean, we celebrate the birth of the Buddha and the enlightenment of the Buddha. Of course, there are many Buddhist holidays, things that we don't celebrate so much as is done traditionally in the East. But those are the significant events that are marked in the Buddhist tradition. But the Buddha himself, certainly has a place, but there's not the kind of devotion you would think, or the kind of attention given that you would think to the founder of the tradition. And that's because that attention is given to the Dharma. And that's exactly how the Buddha set it up and made explicit in his final words before he entered Nirvana. It's the Buddha's enlightenment, his great awakening, his liberation. And not even so much his enlightenment, but enlightenment itself. Not his liberation, but liberation itself. For the Buddha, his liberation was very significant. It's liberation itself that is significant for us. Because if it wasn't something that was directly available to each of us, then it would just be a tradition of venerating something that happened a long time ago, but sorry, folks, we're out of luck. Good night and good luck. It's not that way at all. And so we do what the Buddha did as he laid out in his own teaching. We examine the nature of suffering. And by examining the nature of suffering, we're also discovering the cessation of that suffering. It's interesting that when I looked up vigil, it's defined as a period of keeping awake during a time usually when we're asleep, and that fits pretty well. But it also had a definition of a stationary, peaceful demonstration in support of a particular cause, typically without speeches. And I thought, well, that works pretty well too. Stationary, peaceful, and demonstrating that stillness, that peacefulness in our own body and mind, in the embodiment, in the bringing to life a particular cause, and typically without speeches. Although a few will wander in and out. Kazan, in his commentary to this case, so this is drawn from the transmission of light, which Kazan, which is several generations after Dogen, so this is 13th century Japan, assembled this collection of cases based on the what is said to be the enlightenment experiences of these teachers, beginning with the Buddha and ending with Dogen's disciple, Ajo. And so in this, Kazan says, Shakyamuni left his palace one night when he was 19 years old and shaved off his hair. After that, he spent 6 years practicing ascetic exercises. Subsequently, he sat on an indestructible seat, so immobile that there were cobwebs in his brows, a bird's nest on his head, and reeds growing up through his mat. And thus he sat for 6 years. I think of the Buddha, as I spoke about earlier this morning, you know, this person, this human being, and how in our recent trip to India, it really, you know, since, you know, I assume for most practitioners, you know, that when we begin practicing, in a formal way at least, you know, we're met with these images on the altars and these persons, the Buddha, other teachers in the lineages, as well as the bodhisattvas, and begin to develop some kind of relationship, understanding with these beings. That's what the last Sangha was about, that we made the theme of Buddha ancestors. But the humanity of the Buddha, you know, which I've always, you know, I think most of us really try and connect to, because that is connecting to our humanity and our Buddha nature. That when we were in India, it was much easier to do that because we were in that very place, standing on that same ground. And there was something wonderful about that, very wonderful about that. And I thought about, you know, the actuality of the Buddha, you know, living such a privileged life and leaving it, you know, deliberately leaving it. And really entering into, you know, when he left, he didn't know. I mean, I assume he didn't know that he was going to become, you know, a Buddha. He seemed very clear and committed to his path. But did he know how that was all going to play out? You know. So he was really leaping into the great unknown, a great uncertainty. And although there were many people at his time doing that, he was still, you know, completely dependent upon, you know, his begging rounds and surviving, you know, wild animals in the woods. And there were monks and nuns who died just by living their life, being in the woods with wild animals, tigers and poisonous snakes, and there are things in the sutra. I read something on Friday night from a sutra in which the Buddha talks about being afraid in the woods because of what he knew was there, right, and had the potential to cause harm. And so it was a very real thing. You know, we can look back and think, yeah, he left the home, you know, on this clear trajectory to become this enlightened being, but it wasn't clear when he left home. I think of the courage, the imperative that he felt, must have felt, and the confidence. Kazan says, the behavior of Shakyamuni Buddha during his lifetime is a model for the disciples he left behind. Even though he may have had the 32 special marks of greatness and the 80 kinds of refinements, he kept the form of an old mendicant, no different from anyone else. These 32 special marks are said to be special physical characteristics of a perfectly enlightened being, of which there is only one at any particular time in history, but that there have been many throughout the countless eons that Buddhism recognizes as sort of the history of the cosmos, and the Shakyamuni was just the last one to appear. But what the point Kazon is making is that even though he had all these characteristics and was this deeply enlightened being, he kept the form of a wandering mendicant. He basically lived the life that his other students were living, one walking with his bowls, begging, no different from anyone else. It says, therefore, ever since he was in the world, those who have sought the way of his teaching have followed the Buddha's form and manners, that is, his way of practicing, of living his life, and have used the endowment of the Buddha, and in all their doings have always considered the task of self-understanding foremost. Having been transmitted from Buddha to Buddha, from adept to adept, the true teaching has never been cut off. The story clearly points to this. How do we use the endowment of the Buddha? It's your own endowments. That what the Buddha had that was necessary in order to practice and awaken is what we have. Since practice is about opening up to, entering into our endowments, our natural endowments, to awaken from the sleep state of the conditioned self. You know, I was thinking in the dedication, the pure Dharmakaya neither comes nor goes. The waves of great compassion seem to appear and disappear. What is that saying? You know, one of the things that's so wonderful about the Zen tradition that I love so much is its language. The pure Dharmakaya neither is born nor dies, and yet the waves of compassion appear to come and go. It's like sentient beings are numberless. I vow to alleviate all of their suffering. How do we realize the unity that is the natural state of all things, that recognizes our humanity, our physical endowments, the body and mind, the time and space we actually live in, the limitations that we experience, the obstructions we encounter? How do we live within that real world, in this human body, in this lifetime, and bring forth the pure Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha, that has no limitation, no restriction, no boundary? We have this human life, we have intellect, we have emotion, we have consciousness, we can think, we can create in our mind things that don't exist. We can plan, we can make choices. We can feel an impulse and move towards it or not. We can see what is skillful and what is not skillful. And yet we go through these cycles over and over again. Of fear, of anger, pride, jealousy, arrogance, insecurity, sadness. How do we break the cycle? Well, if we want to break the cycle, we have to understand, before we go breaking something, we have to understand what is it we're trying to break. Because that will have everything to do with what we think breaking is about. How do we use all of this endowment? And that's one of the wonderful things about Buddha Dharma is, in the Zen tradition, there's a lot of value in frugality, not wasting. Right? Not wasting anything. Literally. Not wasting anything. Not wasting suffering. Not wasting obstructions. Not wasting anger, pride, jealousy, arrogance, insecurity. So much of practice is learning how do we not waste it. Not only how do we not be used by it, but how do we use it? And so the Buddha said we have to cultivate our natural compassion, our natural sense of morality, our natural sense of being in the world in a way that isn't based in destruction. And moreover, that is life-giving, life-affirming. And we also have to concentrate our minds. We must concentrate our minds. Because when the mind is not concentrated, the mind is disturbed, it's distracted. And in its distraction, it experiences the world as a real world. And it acts on that world. When the mind is concentrated, we experience the world differently. And we must see into this world. We must see it directly, the Buddha said. What is it that appears before us? Shakyamuni left his palace one night. We too have to leave. We actually have to leave home, internet notwithstanding, to encounter the teachings. We have to go to the place where the teachings are being offered, which means we have to be in the physical presence of the place where they're being offered, which means we will be in the place, presence not only of a teacher, but also of a sangha. We will be in a place where Dharma practice is happening. We will be in the midst of the three treasures. And we also have to leave our inner home. I spoke the other night about how in order to, you know, as part of human nature, that when we're, you know, when we're well-fed and warm, we go to sleep. The tendency is to go to sleep, right? When everything is just right, right? Sometimes I think, is it too beautiful here? One of the nice things about the temple in the city, although the city to me is a very, very beautiful place. I remember thinking about that when I first started working in the prisons. And I thought, for everyone here, guards, administrators, prisoners, the first noble truth must be very clear to them. So we have to also leave the place of our familiarity, because it's part of human nature that until we move into an area we have not been in before, we're not learning, right? We're not developing. And so that's why practice is inherently uncomfortable, disruptive. We were talking at the board meeting last weekend about making the place more welcoming. It was part of our Jizo House project and Jizo project to create spaces that are easier to be in, particularly for people who are aging and just have different limitations. And somebody mentioned about having to stand in a long line to wait for the bathroom, right? And how that creates, you know, a lot of annoyance. And that we're trying to, sort of get rid of this discomfort. And I said, well, not actually all of it. That's not a design that we have created, right? That it's good for your training to wait for a long line in the bathroom, and so we're only going to have a few bathrooms. That wasn't a plan, right? It's just how the building came, and so we're creating new bathrooms. But I said that a certain amount of discomfort and tension is necessary. And it's not really hard to provide for. Just show up. Right? And you'll find it. But that within training, just as this vigil makes clear, as Sesshin makes clear, as being in residency makes clear, as being a sustained practitioner makes clear, that it is challenging. And that in those challenges, we have the chance to move into a space we haven't been in before. And not just to move into it and make a new nest like the old one, but actually to bring about a revolution, to go a different way. And so the Buddha left home because he knew for him he had to do that. He couldn't stay home. He needed to leave that place. Kazan says, with just one robe and bowl, he lacked nothing. Why bring up the robe and bowl? From the beginning, he lacked nothing. As do we. And to think of the faith that he had to have had, right? As he studied with different teachers who under whom he trained and accomplished what they offered him to accomplish. And he verified, yes, you have accomplished within yourself what I have to teach. You have attained it. And he said, no, I have not. What kind of faith did he have? What was guiding him? I really think that it is the same that exists within us, and yet for the Buddha, thankfully, it was much more profound, much more pronounced. So we all have an inkling, a sense, an intuition towards that which is true. That's how we get here. But for the Buddha, in some way, I think it must have been so clear, so strong in him, that he was not seduced. And he wasn't trying to be, they weren't trying to seduce him. They were actually just saying, yes, I am a teacher of this community. I have attained something that this community is drawn to, and that's what I am teaching, and you have accomplished this. And the Buddha said, yes, I recognize that. Thank you. But this is not what I'm looking for. And then when he went and studied for those years with the ascetic, that group of small group of ascetic practitioners, and fully committed himself to that up to the point of his virtual almost death, so that he could say, I have taken this as far as it is possible to take it. I mean, think about that. He needed to know, is this a viable path? Well, how would he know? How could he know? He would have to take it as far as it was possible to take it in order to either realize it as a viable path, because then he was realized his own liberation, or didn't. But he had to know that he didn't because it was not possible, not because he had not in some way engaged it. What kind of inner power, inner confidence, inner sort of guiding light was working within this person? And not where, you know, we're looking back and we say, yeah, but then he went on to realize enlightenment. He didn't know that. He just knew that so far everything that he had committed himself to was not the realization of his path. With just this, you lack nothing. And so then he sat under that Bodhi tree and on his own enlightenment uttered, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. That at that moment, everyone in the world, in the past, present, and future, realized enlightenment. Attained enlightened nature. And there were still fires burning on the mountain. How can that be so? The Buddha realized the enlightenment of all beings, that fundamentally suffering does not exist in the world, that no one creates, no one extinguishes. And as he considered teaching, he despaired of teaching because he said there is so much infatuation with attachments, there are so many fires burning, no one will be able to hear it. You know, one of the things that I didn't know is that after the Buddha was enlightened at what is now Bodh Gaya, it said that during the next week, the next 7 days, he stood at a distance to the tree and stared at it, unblinking. What's that? I haven't come across any explanation, which is wonderful. What's that? He stood and stared unblinking at the tree under which he gained enlightenment. And there's a small temple there now. And then the next week he spent walking back and forth between the tree and that spot. What was going on? What was happening in this most profound moment? Master Dogen says, in the Eheko Roku, he says, Buddha after Buddha extends their hands. Ancestor after ancestor transmits to each other. What do they transmit to each other? And what do they hand over? If the Great Assembly now knows its ultimate position, then the Buddhas of past, present, and future, and the generations of ancestral teachings wear through their sandals and break their wooden ladles, exhausting their strength in the effort without being willing to stop. If you hesitate, I will remain at your feet. What did they transmit, he asks. What did they hand over? If you, in this moment, know your ultimate position, if you know, here and now, life and death is of supreme importance, all things are in a constant state of impermanence. All conditioned existence is dukkha. If you know your ultimate position, then the Buddhas of the past, present, and future are wearing out their sandals and breaking their ladles with which to feed you, exhausting their strength, and they will not be willing to stop. And if you hesitate, I will stand here. I will remain at your feet. What kind of faith is that? What kind of compassion is that? Fulfilling the Buddha's original awakening, I and all beings together at the same moment attain the way. That's the great strength of the Bodhisattva. You know the story of how Kenon, after having alleviated the suffering of every being in the world, walking away, mission accomplished, turned back, only to see a whole new host of beings come over the horizon in suffering, and her head blew apart. Not out of joy. Right? And yet, she pulled herself back together again, with a little help, because she knew, I and all beings attain the way together at the same time. And so the great power within each of us to be compassionate beings is the more and more we understand that fundamentally suffering has never been created and destroyed, and there is so much suffering in the world. Hopelessness is a point of view at a distance. Despair is a perspective that can only be held at a distance. Skepticism, cynicism, harsh judgment, all of those illnesses can only be held at a distance. Attain enlightenment at the same time was the Buddha's moment, realizing there is no distance. No one is hopeless. Nothing is finished. So then, how do we leave someone out? Who do we leave out? How do we forsake ourselves? How do we see ourselves as that hopeless one? As compelling and convincing as that can seem, that view can only be had at a distance. And so as Dogen says, if we stop talking about it and practice and let that distance close, then that affliction returns to its natural state. Kazan says, even so, I and together are neither one nor two. I attain enlightenment, I and all beings on earth together attain enlightenment at the same time. Kazan says, I and together are neither one nor two. Your skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all together. And the host inside the house is I. It does not have skin, flesh, bones, or marrows. It does not have gross physical or mental elements. The pure Dharmakaya neither comes nor goes. Ultimately speaking, if you want to know the undying person in the house, how could it be apart from this very skin bag? Waves of compassion seem to appear and disappear. So you should not understand the beings on earth as distinct from yourself, which means their suffering and their joy, their delusion and their enlightenment as distinct from yourself. That's what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, to see the Buddha and the enlightenment of the Buddha and all of those qualities of the Buddha is not distinct from ourselves. Kazan says, so studying from every angle, passing through in every way, you should clarify the Buddha's enlightenment and understand your own enlightenment. I want you all to see this closely and be able to speak of it. And let this speaking of it flow from your own heart, not borrowing from the words of another. That's what the Buddhas have transmitted. Speaking from your own heart, letting your own experience usher forth. Encountering the miraculous present. The whole world is at peace. I and all beings at the same time attain the way. But what are we to do about all the fires burning on the mountain? Sitting, standing, lying down, walking. The four postures of practice, the totality of our life, each and every moment exploding, each and every step, intimate encounter. This is how we meet the pure Dharmakaya. This is how we bring forth the great healing. That is the legacy of the Buddha. One master said that although the Buddha renounced his asceticism, he retained one ascetic practice throughout his life. What was that ascetic practice? He was never alone. But the actual fact is he did live like all the others, all the other students, throughout his life. And so he would. He would go off into the woods by himself and practice. That he said in the first watch of the night from 6 to 10, he practiced sitting and walking meditation. Through the second watch of the night, you get some rest. Through the third watch of the night, from 2 to 6, you wake up refreshed and you sit and you walk, do your meditation. And that's what he did all throughout his life. And he would go off and practice in solitude and then he would return to not be alone. And that too is our example. That when we really understand the nature of the path, it's not about an end. It's not about completion. Each and every moment exploding. Each and every step, intimate encounter. That's our inheritance. That's why I make prostrations to the Buddha. You know, I was watching a documentary that was made on the Buddha, on the Dalai Lama. And there's one, I was just telling the person who sent it to me, that there was one moment for me that just was the whole thing. They were giving a celebratory event for him for his 80th birthday. So there was all kinds of, you know, stuff going on, lots of people. But he came in, you know, 80 years old, really needing help to walk. And he came up to the Buddha and he began to prepare to do bows. And there were two monks on either side of him, four altogether. And I thought, What's going on? And he went down to do his bows, and then they stepped in to help him stand up. And then he did another bow, and then they helped him stand up. And then he did another bow, and they helped him stand up. As long as it is possible, he will bow to the Buddha. That is his life. That is his repaying of a debt of gratitude. That is his bringing forth his own endowments. What a wonderful legacy.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.